Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So, Jake, at first, this show didn't look like it was necessarily obviously going to forward any major storylines or solve anything based on the lineup. It felt like not a completely random group of matches, but the poster that they put out, the graphic they put out with 30 people on it without, like, the standard clear showcase centerpiece match made it feel like a bit of an ensemble episode. Maybe – I won't call it a filler episode, but – well, maybe a filler episode. It just where it's let the wrestling do the talking. But I actually think they did advance some storylines pretty well when it comes to setting up key matches at Revolution coming up in a few weeks. What do you think? Was that kind of your thoughts going in, look at the lineup and how you feel coming out of this, that maybe this was a little more newsworthy or at least forwarded some things more than just being a show that's self-contained?
Well, I thought they did a really nice job with the MJF segment with Christopher Daniels, which wasn't really advertised ahead of time. It was just, you know, MJF makes a contractually obligated appearance or whatever it was on the poster. Yeah. You know, it's good in joke if you understand the story there. But
yes.
I think that might have been the best segment on the show, you know, by a pretty wide margin. And to have it go completely unadvertised feels like a bit of a shame in hindsight. But you know, there was a couple of other stories that got forwarded here and there, and it didn't feel like a throwaway episode or a complete filler episode, but I didn't think it was nearly as electric as a couple of the previous episodes. And so it's one of those things where, yeah, it kind of outperformed the lineup on paper, but I still wouldn't call it a home run or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I had a low bar for the show in terms of newsworthiness, and I think that segment with MJF and then Christopher Daniels coming out and going, there's a time where I would have taken the money, but not now. And then cutting a promo on behalf of Bryan Danielson, talking about his history and why MJF should fear him. You know, I mean, cutting the promo that in a way Danielson just won't do for himself.
You know, like I don't necessarily think it would have come across particularly well if smiling babyface Bryan Danielson would have went out there and just bragged himself up for 15 minutes. So
exactly.
I think it actually worked pretty well.
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about that segment and what you liked about it.
Well, I guess, you know, it's been a while, so I kind of forget how good Chris Daniels is on the microphone, and so it was refreshing to hear his voice and get his perspective, and I think he added a lot of nice. You know, he rounded out a lot of the details that, you know, a lot of people may be unfamiliar with because most people only know, you know, Bryan Danielson as the Daniel Bryan from WWE. And I'm sure there's a lot of AEW fans who followed him prior to that. But it's nice to have the explanation out there for a lot of the TV audience who may or may not be familiar. You know, he got his start on the independent scene, and you know, his style of wrestling was had a lot to do with why Ring of Honor was formed to start with, and his approach to learning something in the ring every time he's out there, and how that sort of scientific approach to wrestling led him to be, you know, who a lot of people consider is the best technical wrestler working today. And that's not just, you know, people who follow wrestling. It's people in the industry who would put forward that opinion. And so I like the promo. I think it was a very good change of pace to go back to something that was tightly focused on the match and the stakes and the participants in the Revolution match in comparison to that rather controversial, you know, story time scumbag MJF that happened last week. And so I think it was a change in the right direction, and I thought the performances from both MJF and Chris Daniels were very good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Chris Daniels, we don't see a lot of him on the mic. This is one of his better promos I've ever seen him do. And it was on behalf of someone else, but there's, you know, a maturity and experience. And then he just got to talk about things he's familiar with, you know, his history with Bryan Danielson and ROH, which, you know, in a way spawned or begat what the movement that led to AEW, and going back to the indie show, the King of the Indie show that inspired ROH. Hey, we can sell tapes with great indie stars who can't get jobs on the national scene and make money from hardcore fans, you know, and give better payoffs to indie guys who are great workers. I mean, that is kind of what ROH was based on, even if it had some people from ECW who had a history there at the helm. You know, Gabe Sapolsky especially really wanted to contrast and do something different than Paul Heyman's vision. So having Danielson talk about that along with Danielson, it felt natural for him, and he seemed in his element. MJF's promo was really good. And this is, I mean, story time and you know, the promos that, you know, Edge was doing this for a while too last year, the four-year Emmy consideration promos, you know, where it's like, I'm going to have big dramatic range and emotional roller coasters and talk about a heavy issue. I mean, those work now and then, but, or the promo where it's like, oh, I want to get a buzz on the internet. I can't wait to see what people say on Twitter when I'm done with this promo. Okay. You know, now and then I get that, but the goal is to sell tickets and build up a match and build up your heel persona. And this is MJF showing, kind of flexing that he can do that. There was nothing here that's going to be like exciting for him to hit refresh constantly on social media tonight. You know, what will people think of what I did? It was just a good heel promo. And to go back and talk about how fans like Danielson, because he has 5-star bangers and does the best cool moves, and that the schmucks in the crowd used to be devil worshipers, but he turned on them because they're fickle before they could turn on him. It was just, it felt like a good go-home promo in a way, right before pay-per-view, just tying together his journey, his character, his stance with fans. And I'll take more of that from MJF. I mean, I don't think we need the fancy stuff that strays from him being a scumbag and talking about his opponent this way. And I know he's creative, and a lot of wrestlers are creative and want to come up with really cool concepts, but this felt more grounded, and it is, I think, one of his better and more effective promos since he committed clearly to being a heel after all the controversies and hiatus.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the fact that it was so focused on the match and his title reign and what he doesn't like about Bryan Danielson made it all the better, you know, because in the end, the idea of the promo, you know, despite MJF spending the first couple of minutes of it just putting the guy down, was to put over Danielson as an opponent, which is something that they haven't really done with this feud, at least with words. You know, they've had him doing the dream match gauntlet, which is something that all of MJF's opponents seemingly have to go through at this point. But they haven't really gotten down to the point of making Danielson feel like a threat to MJF and making MJF look like he's been gotten to in some way until tonight. And so I hope that continues for, you know, the couple weeks they have left until the pay-per-view, because they really have an opportunity to do something special with this one.
Yep, I agree. I thought the vignette with Danielson was good too. You know, where he was bloodied and you know, pretty intense. He made me believe more, and this was earlier in the show. He made me believe more that he wants to beat MJF and wants to become champion. He said MJF's actions were that of a scared and desperate man, a desperate man scared that someone's coming to take his AEW World Championship. And I thought the words were good, and it was succinct and to the point. So, yeah, I just thought this was a good night in terms of promoting the most important match at Revolution in a few weeks. And so, you know, thumbs up across the board for that. And they could have added, I think there's a contractual obligation to appear. They could have said that MJF will have someone from Danielson's past who is going to expose Danielson. You know, I mean, they could have said something along those lines to hype it. I don't think they'd want to give away that Daniels was the one doing it, although they could have. But I mean, I think there would have been more negative than positive.
Yeah, I think, you know, MJF exposes the real Bryan Danielson or something would have been fine. Anything to let you know, the subject matter of the promo ahead of time. Because I think it was kind of played for a joke, and maybe that works for a certain portion of the audience, but maybe not if you're on the fence about the pay-per-view. I don't know if you're going to tune into a contractually obligated MJF promo.
I get that, yeah. All right, well, let's pause here and introduce ourselves in the show, and then we'll get on to more conversation about Dynamite and listener interaction. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, February 15th, 2023. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and the host of various podcasts throughout the week, including the weekly flagship edition of the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, Rich Fan from the PW Torch VIP podcast titled Everything with Rich and Wade, joined me yesterday on the flagship, so check that out. Search Wade Keller on your podcast app and subscribe to the Blue Logo Show, and you can listen to our conversation about primarily previewing Elimination Chamber, talking about acting in wrestling and the new stress that, or the new importance of being a good actor to be a top-level performer in this ever-changing and evolving wrestling business, and ranking the acting performances and abilities of those in Evolution, and also speculating on the futures of people like Cody and MJF in Hollywood, and looking back at some of the old prior movies, prior wrestlers who got into acting, you know, from, you know, Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan to John Cena and The Miz and even Shawn Michaels. So fun stuff there and some other topics too. Check that out if you haven't yet. But we are here tonight to talk AEW Dynamite on the post show. And my guest co-host is Jake Barnett from ProWrestling.net. Jake, it's great to have you back to talk about Dynamite tonight.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be here, man. I like joining you.
Thank you. Let's shift to the main event tonight, because they main evented with – oh, I didn't give out the phone numbers. I totally jumped ahead. So let me do that. Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation tonight, if you're live streaming the show, is, I should know this by heart, 347-215-8558. That's why I repeat it, because if I don't have it memorized, listeners don't. 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That'll flag you on the switchboard, and that lets us know that you want to be on the show. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. That's wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. I want to talk about the main event, and then we'll get on to listener interaction here with some other topics. Tony Storm, Ruby Soho, and Britt Baker, main event of the show. Like I said, on paper, it wasn't obvious which match would main event. But I think of the matches, if you believe the main event spot is reserved for at least a match tied for the most important on the show. The most important match doesn't always have to be the last match doesn't always have to be by far the most important match, but it shouldn't be a big drop off. And I thought this felt like the most important match on the show, I guess. Cause you have, you know, three top tier wrestlers in terms of being in the top tier of the women's division, with the backstory of you've got Storm and Saraya as the outsiders, so to speak, Britt Baker as the AEW original, so to speak, and then Ruby Soho, somebody who's been around AEW longer than Storm and Saraya. She feels like it's home, but she did first gain fame in WWE outside of AEW, and so she's kind of torn between these two growing locker room factions, so to speak. I think they caught people up on that storyline, or reminded them, or summarized it adequately, not tremendously, but adequately. And then went on and had a heart-hitting main event that didn't solve anything, but I think it underlined the notion that Ruby is really frustrated being pulled in two different directions. And so I thought for a show that didn't have an obvious main event, this came across fine. It was solid in this spot. Jake, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the match was fine. I'm surprised they didn't move the story further along than they did. It just felt like, oh, more tension, more pressure, you know, will she or won't she? And I don't know if that they've been hitting enough home runs with this whole outsiders versus originals thing to want to, you know, drag this out until Revolution or whenever they plan on doing the reveal of which side Ruby Soho is on. I guess to me it seems like the story has been a little underwhelming, and so the fact that they put this in the main event and they gave it a spotlight and they put on a good match only to have the story just kind of fizzle out without any sort of progress at the end, I felt like that was a bit underwhelming. But I will give them credit for putting on a hard-hitting match and having it be enjoyable and feeling like it did fit in that main event slot. It's just the angle leaves a little bit to be desired.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like the angle better than you do, I think. because in part Soraya seemed so poorly cast initially as a babyface, and you know, oh, I'm a big deal because of who I was elsewhere, so I'm obviously going to just move to the top. And AEW fans like Britt Baker more than they like Soraya. In AEW, at least, I think that's, you know, a pretty clear majority, not 100%, but a clear majority. And so I like that they kind of got this cast correctly and now put Ruby Soho in the middle. And I think they've done a good enough job with this. Like I said, I mean, this we're a few weeks out from the pay-per-view, and not every episode of Dynamite is going to have just, you know, this pay-per-view caliber matches. And I think they could have done more to build this up throughout the show. I'm curious if they held the audience over the course of 2 hours without really making it clear what the main event is. Sometimes when they don't push the main event, it's because they don't want people to know that's the match they're sitting around waiting for, if they don't think they'll sit around and wait for it. And maybe that was going on here, but AEW doesn't always, you know, it's not like they consistently build up their main events within a show either. So yeah, I'm better on it. And I think that just putting it in this spot, even if they didn't solve anything, it was, I think, an effective way to amplify and spotlight what this major storyline, this major women's division storyline is. And you don't want to bury it on Rampage, and you don't want it to just be promos. So this was a way to kind of just visually show us, yeah, Ruby's kind of in the middle, and we've got these other two factions, and these are the key personalities. So I think this worked for this worked for me, and I think made this major storyline of the women's division feel like a bigger deal and more clear to all types of fans who are watching Dynamite.
Yeah, I guess that it's fair to say that they illustrated where the battle lines are currently. Mm-hmm. There seems, at least, you know, and I agree with your point that they are starting to get people cast in the right positions. I just don't necessarily know if, well, we have all these talented women in this division, and I guess we want to get more of them on TV, so let's invent a faction wars scenario and just put them all around the world champion, and then they can kind of jockey for who gets title shots. And I think it's been a story that they've repeated in other aspects of the show, and I don't know if they're necessarily allowing any of the women individually to continue, you know, to really add nuance to their personalities in the process. And so that's where I feel a little bit underwhelmed, is that you end up in a situation where, okay, you recognize that there's a problem. You know, the women's division feels kind of cold. We have people in the wrong positions. And rather than pick a couple of them and really focus on them and allow them to develop characters that the audience can get attached to, and taking advantage of the characters that are already over, you know, I think the world champion Jamie Hayter is incredibly over. You know, they've just kind of put us into a position where we have to pay attention to six or seven people, and none of them really stand out in a way that makes them seem like overwhelming stars. And so I guess that's where I'm coming from, and I'm not saying that, you know, it's the fault of the performers. I just think the creative is letting them down a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a higher standard to hold them to. That is very fair, because I think what you're saying there, if they were doing that, if they were executing those elements better, I think this would have felt more natural in the main event spot, and it would just be better for all the women involved if their characters are more fleshed out. I'm ready. We'll talk about Mox and Hangman, but I'm ready for them to, you know, just split off and be baby faces fighting heels. I'm really eager for Britt Baker to just get settled in where there is a consistent stretch of a year where we just know how we feel about her as, you know, an AEW viewer. Like, there's just a consistent, you know, constitution to who she is, and fans are either wildly cheering her, or she gets really committed to being booed, and there's nothing inconsistent. Because I think the women's division needs that. You know, AEW needs, I think, more clear-cut heels and babyfaces, frankly. I think they're just a little too ambiguous with it, and I think it leads to some ambivalence and contradictory actions. Like, do you have any idea if the Elite are heels or faces? I mean, they seemed like heels tonight. You know, Don Callis saying, no rematch for you, baby, young babyfaces, who gave us a good fight but lost. And you got Matt throwing a basketball at the nuts of Brandon Cutler, his supposed friend, and there's just sort of an obnoxious boisterousness and irreverence to them. Yet, I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure how we're supposed to feel about them, because their opponents aren't consistently babyfaces, and they don't consistently act as heels. So, well, I'll ask you, what do you think? How are you supposed to feel about the Elite right now?
I guess I lean that they're baby faces, but, you know, I don't know that. And I think the problem is they've been so wrapped up in, you know, that best of seven series, and they never really cut promos during the best of seven, and they really haven't gone through the process of doing much character work coming out of it. And so you're just sort of left to guesswork. And I guess, you know, that's where I'm at. I'm leaning babyface, but I honestly don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's kind of important, like, to know who, what your characters are and not just go, well, we do our talking in the ring with the number of stars we accumulate over the course of our match. Like, that's, you know, they should expect more. So it's an example of many where just let's have that, you know, clear cut heel face faction heel face wrestlers and get people emotionally invested in rooting for certain people. There are absolutely exceptions, and it doesn't mean if you're a babyface, you can't have shades of gray in your character. It doesn't mean dumb down everybody, but, you know, be consistent and let's make it clear who we're supposed to root for. And I think the women's division can use that. And so going full circle, that's why I like, you know, Saraya and Toni Storm being heels, even if you think, oh, Toni Storm should have been a babyface, they blew it, or, you know, whatever your feelings are, at least it's clear, you know, what they're going for here. I kind of stole JB Thunder, so I'll read his email here since it's on topic. JB from Detroit said, do you think this women's match was worthy of main eventing? I think given what we got the rest of the episode, it was fine in the main event spot. I also actually did like the story that was being told and that Ruby had to choose sides between AEW's Women's Originals and the Invaders. Given the context, I thought it worked. So, JB, clearly, I didn't read your email before. I knew your topic, but I didn't read your email beforehand. And you and I are on the same page. And I'll answer it. Yeah, I think it was worthy of the main event spot, given everything else on the show. And I like the storyline. And I did think it worked. And I thought the story they're telling was told well in this match, including Ruby just sort of blowing her top afterward, just going, enough, you know, leave me alone. Now, there is an issue with, will fans, if she ultimately chooses to be aligned with the, you know, we'll call them the AEW Originals, will fans resent her for not choosing sooner, or will they doubt her actual loyalty if that, in the end, is supposed to be a positive attribute that she ultimately chose AEW over these outsiders? Is taking a while to do it and hedging going to undercut that as this virtuous decision on her part, Jake? Or does this sort of tell us, nah, she probably is going to go heel, and that's why it's taking her a while to make the call?
Yeah, I guess that's the risk of stretching it out is, you know, if she does the right thing, then why did it take you so long? And if she does the wrong thing, like, why the crisis of conscience? You know, I guess,
yeah,
it's just one of the, okay, like, so obviously she's, you know, why is she conflicted if the heels are so obviously heels? And I guess the issue is that she hasn't previously gotten along with Hayter and Baker all that well, but this is why she needs an interview or microphone time. Like, explain yourself. Like, it's so much easier when people explain themselves. And I hope she gets that, but it's seemingly so rare for the women's division, you know, for more than like a 30-second backstage segment.
Yeah. JB's got some other good topics here. He says, I felt this particular episode of Dynamite was crowded with average and forgettable factions that are either created on or showcased on what we might consider shoulder content shows like Rampage, Dark, or Elevation. I'm fine with these acts appearing here and there as an enhancement talent, but I felt like the density of them on tonight's show made Dynamite feel lesser than it normally does. Not that I wasn't entertained, though. And I think that's also an accurate assessment of this show. You know, we got to see Mark Sterling's faction, we got to see Stokely Hathaway's faction, Dark Order got more time than usual. Heck, Air Fox and Top Flight, you know, are a three-man team, but they're not top centerpiece main event acts, so they kind of add a little bit to, I think, what JB is talking about here in their slot. I'm not sure if I'm leaving anyone out. I'm not scrolling through the show right now, but it did have that vibe, and I talked about with Rich on the flagship yesterday. I mean, when you put 30 people on a poster advertising a two-hour TV show, that's sort of indicative of, we don't think any two or three things are really going to draw on their own, so we're just going to throw every dart at the board at once and hope something here grabs your attention, or you just think, there's so much going on, I got to tune in to see it. And, I mean, they put a lot of people on their you know, social media posters or graphics, but this was, I believe, a record, and it, there wasn't anyone all that bigger than anyone else. I think Mox and Claudio got the biggest
for lack of a better term, font size on the poster in terms of being featured top and center. But even that, it wasn't super pronounced. Like, this is clearly our top match because of who they were wrestling, which was this, you know, makeshift team with underdeveloped and not particularly great established top personalities in Roosh and Preston Vance. So, yeah, I mean, I felt like it was an average show overall, but it had good enough wrestling, overcame my low expectations at least, and I think did a good job. And we'll get into some other areas where they forwarded storylines and promoted the pay-per-view lineup, including, you know, Mox and Hangman and the Wardlow sit down, Jericho Appreciation Society. I guess it was setting up Friday's match, but that'll probably culminate at Revolution and more. So, yeah, anything you want to add to what I said or JB's point?
No, I think he's pretty well spot on. You know, it did feel like a show that featured a lot of acts that more than likely won't end up featured on the pay-per-view. And if they do, it'll be in, you know, lower card or preliminary matches. And so I think that, you know, this is like the third Dynamite preview prior to the pay-per-view. So there's two more shows until the March 5th Revolution show. And was it four or maybe five matches announced for the Revolution mm-hmm. show? And I think they really do have to get down to focusing on, you know, okay, what are the matches that are going to be in the pay-per-view? How can we, you know, add tension and pressure to these situations? How can we further interest in these characters and stories? And I think if you're, you know, if I guess an hour and 15, 20 minutes of the show is completely irrelevant to the pay-per-view, you're close enough now where that sort of feels like you're wasting your audience's time, right? Or you're wasting your opportunity to, you know, to really sell them on that $50 show that's coming up on Sunday, March 5th. And so I think having the discipline to focus and have fewer people featured on the show and, you know, fewer segments that go a little bit longer that allow you to flesh out more detail is probably the right approach. And I think that's sort of been Tony Khan's, you know, weakness that I've talked with Jason Powell about it. I think you and I have probably talked about it on several occasions over the past year or 18 months. There seems to be this shotgun approach at times to things where it's just, you know, spray as much stuff on this 2-hour show as possible. And a lot of it ends up being somewhat forgettable. And I think that's unfortunate because it is their flagship show.
Yep. I agree with that. His third point out of three is, or actually four, is, will Jungle Boy wrestle Christian at Revolution? If so, will it propel him to some sort of title match at Double or Nothing? I talked with Rich yesterday about, you know, if the either underwhelming or underperforming initial top-tier male singles division. And, you know, where Kenny's just sort of unserious Kenny now in his own division doing his own thing. Hangman Page has lost momentum over the last year and a half. Brian Danielson, you know, is past the time where he wants to be the guy carrying a company on his back as a top guy, and he's getting up there in age. And Moxley, you know, Moxley's just, you know, bleeding everywhere. Everybody sort of had his time on top. Jericho is 52, maybe 52, I think 52 or 53. I mean, so they need this next group, the pillars and the others who have kind of joined that conversation to rise, to elevate, to mature and blossom into true top tier people you can lean on for pay-per-view main events. You've got a number of people. Oh, and even Claudio, you know, like he could have been one of those guys, but he's kind of older. Maybe has been framed and defined down too much. Samoa Joe, older, good for, you know, the role he's in, but you're not going to build the company around him. So they're looking from a depth standpoint at people like the younger people like Wardlow and Jungle Boy and Ricky Starks. And I don't know if Darby has that kind of upside. I don't think so to be any different than where he is now. I think he's in a good spot. So who are going to be those opponents for MJF? Even the big question mark over Adam Cole, which we'll get to, you know, I mean, I'm not sure I'm excited to see him wrestle because I'm scared for him. You know, I mean, the way he's talking about what he's been through, you know, you got to trust the doctors and there could be some amplifying and embellishing of how touch and go it is for him to be cleared. But who are going to be those people to face MJF at a pay-per-view main event level, assuming MJF even sticks around. So this gets to JB's question. Jungle Boy, I think, will wrestle Christian at Revolution. That seems quite logical. That'll be sort of the blow-off match. And if he wins, does beating Christian, who, by the way, is also one of those older, you know, kind of visits the top tier legacy star acts that AEW has, is Jungle Boy somebody who seems like he's on pace to be a top three or four babyface who, yes, you can do a main event pay-per-view, build a main event pay-per-view program around?
I mean, I think it's probably safe to view him that way. I think he has that potential. I do think he probably needs better instincts on the microphone, and whether that comes with maturity or not, we'll have to see. But he's had some, you know, dreadful interview segments, in particular when he was trying to promote that first match with Christian before it got derailed. And so, I mean, does he have that in him? I think so. I mean, it seems like he has all the right tools in the ring. You know, he's over with live crowds. His matches are exciting. He plays the underdog well in matches against larger opponents, which is presumably who he'd be facing in heavyweight scenarios, you know, at the top of the card. And so, yeah, I think it could work out for him, given, you know, that he finds the right personality to adopt. And I think that's really the issue with all of these up-and-comers that, you know, you made mention of in AEW. It's like, can they find the skills on the microphone to really take them to the next level? And we heard a, you know, fantastic promo from Ricky Starks on MJF not that long ago. And so, you know, that potential is there for him. But it, you know, it seems like he's kind of regressed since then, now that he's been feuding with the Jericho Appreciation Society. So being consistently great on the microphone is probably the hardest aspect of being a popular and successful TV wrestler long term. And so it's really, you know, those are the question marks that remain for just about everybody there.
Yeah, I mean, this is a business about storytelling. And if you can't tell your story yourself, that is kind of disqualifying for being an effective top babyface, especially. So you can't just, you know, put somebody who's a top babyface with a manager like you can heels. So, yeah, and I agree with what you said about their about the promos. I mean, the Jungle Boy has had a number of missteps on the microphone. Disappointed that Starks did too when he made fun of people who have speech impediments, as if that was the most awful personality trait somebody could not choose to have and make fun of him for. I mean, like that, you know, talk about Jungle Boy's instincts. I thought that was a real showed real bad instincts on his part. So, but some of that can be fixed with just people's being involved in the topics and the bullet points on promos and talking it through with the wrestlers and guiding them with some wisdom. Don't say this or say this. And, you know, I don't know what Jericho, if Jericho had something to do with Starks making fun of Jake Hager's speech impediment, I thought that'd be funny. I question Jericho's wisdom or whether he's trying to sabotage Ricky. It still just strikes me as like who did not have that off before it made live TV. But I do think Jungle Boy is near the top of the prospects, and if he can get better on the microphone, I think he's got a look and a demeanor and enough skill in the ring for sure, where you can imagine him carrying himself with main event gravitas. It really does come down to how hard is he working to get better on the microphone, and can he get good enough where you can lean on him in that spot. The final point JB brought up is the other person who's an X factor right now, which is Adam Cole, and I brought him up a minute ago too. He says, will Adam Cole have his return match at Revolution? If so, who will he face? Adam Cole's kind of the X factor, because if you go, you know what, Adam Cole's healthy, everything, he's totally cleared, and you can feel good about him wrestling, and he'll wrestle maybe an augmented style to protect his concussions, you know, his brain better. You know, I mean, all those caveats, and I have mixed feelings, you know, about with all the things he says he's going through, you know, almost wanting him to come back unless it's just, you know, but you gotta trust he's his own person. He can make his own choices to a degree. If you're Tony Khan, you gotta oversee that, but mostly you just lean on the medical professionals to make sure they're not clearing somebody who shouldn't be cleared. That all said, he does seem to have this sort of new appreciation, this glow to him about being a wrestler, and it's coming through in his promos. And he's a guy who, even if MJF loses or leaves AEW, Adam Cole's sort of right there, a healthy, durable Adam Cole, but in this state of mind, seems like the least damaged. You know, when it was Punk Danielson and Cole coming in, it was like, you know, who's going to a year and a half later be not the last man standing, but the person who you would keep if you were Tony Khan, if you had to give up two others. And they already lost Punk, perhaps forever. And Danielson is more expendable, because I think you've gotten a lot more out of Danielson than you have from Cole. And not that I want Danielson to go away, but at his age, I just don't think he's going to be a centerpiece babyface or heel for 3 or 4 years. Cole could still be that. So Cole as a babyface sharing the top babyface spot with Jungle Boy and Wardlow, and I'm trying to think who would be like the fourth. Oh, Ricky Starks. Like, that's not a bad crew. I think you can draw ratings on national television building around those four as your top singles babyfaces. So they're there, but none of those are sure bets. You know, there's a lot that all of them still have to prove. Cole, he's proven in NXT what he can do, but in terms of just being durable, and the other three just have to develop their characters a little bit more and their connection with fans at that main event level. Jake, how do your thoughts match up or not match up with what I said about Cole?
No, I think he's right up there, you know, as a lead babyface if he's healthy. You know, and I guess you have to trust the opinions of medical professionals and the data that they have to look at, you know, the state of his head injury and whether he's, you know, fully capable of getting back in the ring and performing at a level that he expects from himself. You know, that's always going to be a risk, you know, just based on what he's described from his post-concussion symptoms. It sounds like he was in a very bad place for a while, you know, feeling like he was going to vomit just trying to, you know, drive a car and you know, waking up with his head spinning and, you know, things that would be genuinely terrifying if you were experiencing them yourself. And so I share the same concerns you do about, you know, is this something that he should be doing? You know, like, is there another aspect of, you know, if he can't wrestle at a level that he would be proud of himself to do and, you know, contribute to his legacy, you know, is there some other role where he would fit? I don't know the answer to that, but just given, you know, the way that he presented himself during, you know, the sit down interview with Renee Paquette on this show, I think there's definitely an energy about him that is, you know, that is contagious. And so if he is healthy and he's able to come back and perform at a high level, I think he could absolutely be your number one babyface if called upon. You know, I just, given the way it's been presented and the fact that, you know, he sort of refused to tip his hand about who he wants to face in the company, and then, you know, they fade to black and they go immediately to MJF's entrance, I don't think that was a coincidence.
Right, yeah. I thought it was a little, I don't know. I that was my least favorite part of the promo. Not that he said it, but I think just the way, I think Renee, who I'm usually a big fan of, I think she played off of it a little too, I don't even know, not flirtatiously, but she's a little too like gregarious about it or something. Like, you know, can we have a little window into it? It just felt like, just ask the question like a professional. I didn't like the tone of that, and I think it threw things off a little bit. It felt just, I don't know, too cute, or like I said, I don't know if gregarious is a word, but that's what came to mind, and that's not what you want in that situation. I'd like a little bit more of a serious tone to the hint being dropped. No big deal, but it just didn't work for me.
It was a little playful, but I think that was
there you go,
spirit
yeah.
of the interview for the most part. But yeah, I think it would, you know, once they actually get down to the point where they're actually ready for him to return, and I don't know if that's, you know, 2 weeks from now or 2 months from now or whatever that might be. But yeah, I hope we do get serious, determined, you know, Adam Cole at some point.
Yeah. All right, now Zach in Texas emailed. He said, Dynamite did a good job making official some matches for Revolution. I thought that the Danielson-MJF segment was well done and made more sense than Cody and Sammy on Monday, despite them both serving the same purpose. There was a logical reason Daniels was out there, MJF's attempted bribe, and a reason he started hyping Danielson. Most importantly, it wasn't about putting Daniels over or making him look good. It was just about Danielson-MJF. I was thrilled that the women main evented. The story has been told very well. It looks like Ruby's getting the title shot at Revolution, where I suspect she officially turns heel and joins the so-called outsiders. I'm just going to go enjoy going along for the ride. So he just said he liked Daniels MJF better than Sammy Cody, or he framed it as it made more sense. And I think they both made sense adequately, like more than adequately. You know, Sammy showed up because he wanted to know if Cody really thought he could win, or he was just, you know, paying lip service, but still just assuming he'd be facing Roman. And that made enough sense for me to call Cody to the ring and Cody to seemingly extemporaneously, not a planned promo, answer Sammy sincerely. So I thought that had plenty of logic to it. But I don't think you have to dislike one to – you don't have to dislike one to like the other. I think they can both make sense. And I think they did. But I am glad they had, you know, a good explanation that I think played well. And by the way, MJF's reaction to Daniels going, here's an envelope of money MJF paid me to say bad things about Danielson, and MJF just seething in the background, like, no, don't, what are you doing? I thought that felt very natural. I thought it was, speaking of acting, good acting on MJF's part, and it added to the segment. So what do you think about Zach's Cody-Sammy comparison?
Yeah, I didn't come away from the Cody and Sammy segment on Monday thinking that it didn't make sense. You know, I think, you know, more than just the, you know, interaction between the two of them, I think it was important for both of them to have an interaction that let the audience know that it's okay to cheer for both of them. And in some ways, it allowed WWE to put Cody Rhodes in the same ring as Sami Zayn in Brooklyn, an area where at times they've struggled to get the crowd reaction they've wanted, and do kind of a heat check to see if Cody was going to get the wrong reaction at WrestleMania or in the build up to it. And they got what they wanted. And so I think it was a win for them. And I thought it made as much sense as it could in the context of the story that they're telling between the two of them and Roman Reigns. But I also thought tonight's segment was excellent. So I don't know if I enjoyed one more than the other necessarily. I think they were both high quality segments, but I guess I didn't come away from it, you know, even thinking to compare the two of them, honestly.
Is MJF overall the best performer in AEW right now, using the cliche hitting on all cylinders? Is there somebody like MJF is the world champion of AEW, and when you think about AEW's launch point and what MJF had accomplished and how many people even knew his name or what he could do, and then the roster that AEW had, and this at this point in 2023, MJF is the class of what remains of that group. You know, Cody, ironic's not the word, but coincidentally isn't there. We're talking about him in a segment, but he's in a segment on the other show. Otherwise, maybe he'd be, you know, I mean, if Cody had stuck around, the number one babyface world champion spot would be his if the fans hadn't, you know, turned against him and he didn't do a gender reveal and some other missteps on his promo that made fans, the type of fans who buy AEW tickets and go to live shows, start rolling their eyes a little too hard at Cody. And so, you know, there was some preventable, foreseeable mistakes that they should have avoided, some missteps they should have avoided along the way.
Even Cody acknowledged that he got a little away from himself during his time in AEW. So I don't even think that's a controversial statement at this point.
No. I'm just sitting here like reminiscing as I talk, and it's just, I'm chuckling at the things that didn't go quite as they should have for Cody. But so just back to my question, I just think MJF is a level better than everybody else in AEW right now. Like objectively, he should be the top paid guy at the center of this company. And it sounds like I'm disparaging everybody else. I mean, this really is more of a compliment of MJF, and I don't love every promo he does. Like, I mean, I think there's aspects of promos where I'd be like, I'd scratch that. I don't think that's the right direction to go. And I thought he had a bad 2022 storyline-wise and character-wise. I think 2023, he is late last year and into this year. It's just, he's just doing great work. And he's clean, you know, his look, the way he's carrying himself, there's some refinement to his presentation. I'm not just talking about his physique, but the way he carries himself, the haircut, the dress, the telling the crowd, this isn't an MJF sing-along, like not leaning in to the, like Seth did as a heel when the fans are singing his song, or Jericho does with his song. Like when the fans are starting to say things, he's just like cutting it off. He knows that's not productive to his goal of being booed. And I was told that, when they decided for him to go heel, there were people doubting whether he could get the fans to boo him, because they had started cheering him so much. And there was serious consideration given to him going babyface. And there's some sense maybe we blew it because he would have been so popular. I think they'll always look at that fork in the road and wonder if it was the right move. The best way to mitigate any regret is to have this heel run go really well. And so far it is. And he's doing things, I think, the right way for a heel in 2023. So I'll throw to you, Jake, your thoughts on where MJF stands and who's competing with him for the argument of MVP of this company.
Yeah, I guess among the people that stood out when the company was starting, I guess you had Cody and Jericho and Moxley and Kenny Omega, and those were probably your top four. And, you had others. Hangman was in there, but he was still kind of on the outside looking in from a main event perspective. I guess I would say, now that we're a couple of years into it, I think MJF has clearly emerged as the most talented all-around performer. He delivers in the ring every time he's out there. He's doing the best character work out of anybody in the company currently. And that's not to say that it's perfect. It's just, he's the top of the class in terms of how much effort he puts into his presentation and his promos and his stories. And, even if there are things that we would do differently if we were making the choices, I don't think that negates the quality work that he's put in. And so, I would agree. He's certainly earned his position. And, I don't know if I necessarily would regret not turning him babyface because I think the way that the opponents are lining up, it's probably going to work out better that he's a heel. And it's allowed, other acts, to kind of go into a rebuild mode behind him. You're going to need to rehabilitate people like Hangman Page and John Moxley. And obviously you've had a lot of unfortunate injuries that have put and other scenarios that have put other people out of action, whether it's CM Punk and Adam Cole and Kenny Omega being out for as long as he was and seemingly being uninterested in being a main eventer at this point in his AEW career. And so I think he's clearly at the top of the mountain. And I don't know that there's anybody in that class competing with him. I mean, clearly Danielson is doing decent character work, but it's not his focus. He just wants to have great wrestling matches. And I guess if you're talking about character work, there probably really isn't anyone putting that level of effort in at this point. I think that's one of the deficiencies of the product. It's something that they have to work on.
Tony Khan talks about, free agents are always going to be there, and that's part of the selling point of AEW is we're going to be a place for, people to go who feel underutilized or miscast or whatever by WWE and elsewhere. And they had, the initial group when the company started, and then they had the surge in August of 2021. But I don't know who WWE is going to let go at this point with all the money they have and AEW's place in the industry as a competitor. I mean, anybody who gets let go, Tony Khan's going to find out there was a reason, that might not be at the forefront of the fans on social media and podcasting complaining about someone deserving more of a push. But, when they land in your locker room, sometimes you find out why they were discarded or considered a malcontent or unprofessional or irresponsible or not committed. And that's the problem. It's like, who's going to become a free agent other than, especially with Paul Levesque in charge of creative, if that continues to be the case, you're not going to have someone like Adam Cole being asked to be a gimmicky manager by Vince McMahon. If that's a true story, I don't have reason to doubt Adam Cole. You're not going to have that anymore. Like, Levesque's going to know who to keep and who to keep from AEW in particular. And that's why, keeping MJF and then homegrown talent becomes more important with the guys they have, but they've got to keep MJF. They've got to keep the other people who are rising up the ranks. And you've got to be successful enough to use your salary cap, so to speak, to keep a Wardlow if he turns out to be a big star with your fan base, or Jack Perry, who, you know, every wrestler in AEW is going to look at WWE and WrestleMania, and yes, I'll say it, the grandest stage of them all, and everything that comes with it, Super Bowl commercials and all of the big time aspects of WWE, and wonder, do I want to be the Sting of my generation, the person who doesn't get there till the end, if ever? And so that's some of what Tony's fighting, and I don't think he should take for granted that free agents are going to come around in the way that Punk, Danielson, and Adam Cole did before. Again, especially as all underlined, with Levesque essentially being in charge of who he's going to pay enough to keep around. It's going to take work. And MJF is hungry. You know, he is more hungry than Kenny Omega right now. You know, he's more hungry than anybody on that roster who has main event credibility already, or is aiming, or is aspiring to it. And that, along with, you know, talent, is what's leading to him, I think, being the standout star right now. And it's not to discard John Moxley, but like I said, Moxley's sort of been there, done that, and you kind of know what Moxley wants to do and wants to be. And it's kind of like with Danielson and the Bucks and Kenny, they kind of want to do their own thing and be happy doing their niche. And it could be a main event niche, but it's not centerpiece heel or face niche like MJF is providing, at least at this moment, for AEW. Zach also brought up that he thinks Ruby's going to join the Outsiders at the pay-per-view. Was there anything in this match that seemed to hint at that, or red herrings that you're disregarding because you think that's what they were, a red herring? Like, anything come through in this match that steers you the way Zach is looking?
I mean, there wasn't anything obvious. I guess there may be some nuance and detail that I missed while trying to transcript the show that I might pick up if I went back and watched it again. But it seemed like the major, you know, will she or won't she moment kind of came in the middle of the match when both of her opponents were on the outside of the ring in range for a suicide dive, and she just kind of hesitated without, you know, making a decision. And so I thought they highlighted her indecision more than they highlighted anything that would have pointed me in either direction. And her reaction after the match to just wanting them to leave her alone, I guess, leads me to believe that they're holding off on her making any kind of overt decision until, I guess, maybe Revolution. Maybe they'll do that on the go home show. It's really hard to say at this point.
Yeah. Yep. A couple other things before I get to another email here. Did you have a problem with Max Caster cutting that, ripping on Jeff Jarrett while acknowledging the death of Jerry Jarrett, which, by the way, Rich Fan and I talked about for about a half hour at the top of yesterday's flagship. So if you want some insight and background on Jerry and some anecdotes, because I knew him, you know, pretty well, and spent a lot of time on the phone with him over the years and interviewed him many times. Did it come across as tasteless or crass of him to do that when the announcers are setting up Jeff as he walks to the ring as someone wrestling with a heavy heart tonight? And I know Jeff's a heel, and obviously Jeff approved of it. I'm not saying, you know, Max went into business for himself and blindsided Jeff in a shoot way, but just from a standpoint of, does that seem tasteless or tawdry, and could it actually put sympathy on Jeff because Max Caster used questionable judgment or made people feel uncomfortable? Or is that just smart because that's what Caster does, and Jarrett's a heel, and he didn't say anything bad about Jerry? How did that stand out to you?
I don't think it came across as like tasteless or anything. It was pretty clear based on Jarrett's entrance to the ring, even though he, you know, the announcers were talking about him, you know, working with a heavy heart because of the passing of his father, that he was still in heel mode. You know, he was still strutting, he was laughing, he was trash-talking fans, he was doing all that stuff. And so I thought Caster remaining in character and delivering that promo was perfectly fine because Jeff was out there in character as well. There wasn't any sort of sympathy-grabbing moment from Jarrett directly. It seemed to be coming, you know, specifically from the announce team at that point.
Well, what do you think of Anthony Bowens' promo later in the show, Karen doing the most of the talking in terms of his delivery, and then kind of separate from that is, and I've seen some criticism of this, the idea that the Acclaimed would choose to cash in their rematch clause, such as those exist consistently, in a match where they have, using WWE math, a 25% chance to win rather than a 50% chance. In non-dumb math terms, they have reduced their odds of winning by being one of four teams in the ring where there's a lot of variables. And just then stepping one step back further from that, what do you think of the decision to not just do a Guns versus Acclaimed rematch? Why add other teams to the mix? Why not just let them go out there and have a more, you know, for the most part, straightforward showcase match? Those are four good young athletes who could have had a pay-per-view moment, and now it's just going to be, I don't want to prejudge too with too much certitude, but it's now gone from a personal feud that's had months and months of buildup, and it finally has a showcase where the babyfaces are trying to get their titles back against Steel, who cheated to win, and now you're going to just have it be a spot fest of two other teams wedged in there. That's my take. I'm willing to see it play out with these battle royals. So multi-pronged question there, but all on the same broad topic. Jake.
Yeah, there's been this ongoing feud, mostly taking place on social media between the Guns and FTR, and so I'm wondering if they may be one of the teams that comes back and gets into the battle royal, and they want to raise the stakes of this match by including more high profile teams that may, you know, look good on a pay-per-view card and sell a few more shows, but just from a logic and intellect perspective, it does make them look kind of buffoonish not to just execute their rematch clause, you know, the next week on Dynamite or the week after the pay-per-view or something along those lines, you know, when they can get a singles match. So it does make them look pretty silly, but from a we want to sell pay-per-views perspective, I'm assuming they want to add some more star power to the match, and that will happen in those battle royals over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Your thoughts on the Guns? It was just a brief moment with them tonight, but on promo and on the stage, are they carrying the belts the way you would hope, given what their characters are? I thought it was like a good week for them. I mean, they're this obnoxious team that you want to see get beat, and I don't think they're going to go down at this stage in this reign as the most credible champions. But they're the type of champions where when AEW has so many belts, you can get away with a team like them having the titles. And I thought they were sufficiently obnoxious and abrasive tonight in the chances that they had to show that.
Yeah, I think they were obnoxious. They were unapologetic. You know, we didn't have to go through the indies because of who we were. And, you know, we don't really care if you hold that against us or not. It seemed like they were addressing Dax Harwood, who on his podcast, you know, made a direct reference to some people not having to work their way up from the bottom. They are who they are because of who their dad is and that kind of thing. So I wasn't a huge fan of them sort of talking past the Acclaimed to respond to something that happened on a podcast that a fraction of the TV audience would be aware of. But I think they won the championships in a bad, you know, with a bad finish and a rough match. And they feel like the best course of action is for them to be completely delusional heels who think that they've earned everything that they have. And I mean, I think it could work if they continue to develop the characters and give them a bit more promo time. But, it wasn't like, oh man, these guys are really knocking it out of the park. They only had like 30 seconds to talk anyway.
Yeah. Yes. All right, very good. Let's go to Bryant in Boston. Bryant, thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. How about you?
Not too bad. I have to say, though, for the first time in a while, I was kind of underwhelmed by the show. Like, the first hour was solid, but it kind of trailed off in the second hour. I mean, One thing we definitely didn't need was the Dark Order coming out and having mic time. I mean, you don't need that to advance. You don't need that to advance the feud between Cage and Moxley. You're essentially giving jobbers mic time, and that wasn't necessary. So that's one part I didn't like. And also, I thought the women's match was kind of underwhelming. I didn't think it was as good as it could have been. I mean, I do think it should have been the main event, but I don't know. It was just kind of missing something. There wasn't like really, I don't know. I don't think Ruby Soho should have won. I mean, when was the last time Britt Baker won a big match? It's been a while. And she already beat Toni Storm a couple weeks ago, and then she won again on Rampage. So I don't really think she needed the win. Plus, that roll-up finish in a triple threat match is the lamest thing ever. I mean, WWE did that thing to death back in the day. And it's just a stupid way to finish a match. I don't know what you guys thought of that at all.
Well, it's funny you bring that up because that was Hangman's that was part of the Hangman Moxie build is this can't end on a roll-up. This feud deserves a finish, not a roll-up. It deserves somebody being knocked out who doesn't get back up, not a roll-up. And then, you know, how do they end their main event, you know, with a roll-up after, you know, shenanigans and a distraction and chaos. Jake, your reaction to what Doc Bryan said?
Yeah, the only reason that I could think that Ruby got the win is because they're setting up another triple threat at the pay-per-view. Like they want either Saraya or Toni Storm along with Ruby to challenge Jamie Hayter, and it's going to be another, you know, who is Ruby going to side with match where, you know, do the heels have an advantage? Or and I don't know if that's the most compelling story necessarily, but I think that may be the direction they're going, and getting her a TV win sort of establishes a reason for her to be featured in a title match. But, you know, I guess we'll have to see where it goes the next couple of weeks, because I think one of the parts of the match that I criticized earlier when Wade and I were talking was the fact that they didn't really advance the story, and they kind of left it completely open for interpretation as to where Ruby is headed next. And so, yeah, it's been a fairly, I guess, mediocre story for Saraya and Toni Storm so far, because they've had a heel turn. You know, people were kind of excited about that, and then they've kind of been languishing in attempts to try to establish individual personalities for them. And I don't think spray painting L's on people is necessarily a winning formula either.
The NWO went out of fashion like 25 years ago. Yeah, the NWO went out of fashion about 25 years ago, so the spray paint thing doesn't really work anymore. Yeah. I just think that the way the women's division over the past year just hasn't been booked as well as it could be. First of all, you don't need two singles titles. I mean, that personally, I think the TBS title should just go the way of the dinosaur. That and the trios title too, because I listened to the podcast, the extra part you had with Rich Fan earlier today, and I, you know, and you were talking about how AEW isn't really growing or doing what it needs to do, and I have to say I agree. It's part of it is because they have too many titles. I mean, the trios division has absolutely killed the tag team division. I mean, now you've got, I mean, back before the trios title, you know, you had like the Bucks going at it with the Lucha Brothers. You had all sorts of great matches, and now you get the Guns and the Acclaimed. And they're two solid teams, but no one's going to pay money to see a match like that. So I just want to run a couple ideas by you guys, see what you think. And, you know, then I'll kind of close it out for the night. But first idea is get rid of the trios titles. They really do nothing. And to be honest, the Elite, whenever I've noticed a recurring pattern with the Elite in their quarter hours. The quarter hours absolutely tank when they come on. Like, it's been like 100, 200,000 viewers in past episodes. And the last match they were in, I think it was last week, their match absolutely tanked in the ratings. So I think maybe feature them a little less. And I think just getting rid of the trios titles, they're not necessary. You know, you could just take all those trios that have been formed, just feed them back into tag team division so you get a compelling team. So I just wonder what you guys' thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I'm against the trios titles.
Yes.
I think AEW has too many belts. I mean, I Yeah, I'm with you. I think it waters down what would otherwise be a deep tag team division, and it plays into the belts for everybody problem in AEW, and it plays into the idea that every wrestler sort of gets their own little corner of the booking landscape to do their own thing. Jake, your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess kind of preaching to the choir here. I think the lessons of trios championships pretty much everywhere that they've been attempted, and it's not just in recent history. You know, we're talking, decades into the past. Anytime you really build up a three team or a three man tag team title, it's at the expense of your tag division, and that's not been something that that's ever really been a success story anywhere. I mean, outside of maybe the Von Erichs and the Briscoes drew money with the with trios titles at one point, or excuse me, the Von Erichs and the Freebirds. And so
yeah.
I can't think of really anywhere that the trios titles have really drew money. And so I think moving away from that, I think some of the secondary titles, the All Atlantic Championship feels a bit superfluous. The TBS Championship that seemingly was created to keep Jade Cargill away from the other women's championship for as long as possible. I don't know how necessary that is going forward. I would much rather see Jade more involved in the rest of the division and involved more on television as she's improved, fairly dramatically over the course of the last 18 months. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of things that could be done to get more stars interacting with other big stars and less matches happening just for the sake of having matches and titles that exist to keep important players on the show apart and allow them to have their own little world to exist in. We saw the long-term outcome of that with the Codyverse before he left the company. And I think we're seeing it sort of pop up with other wrestlers as well now. And it is something that I hope they get away from eventually.
I'm okay with having two men singles titles. I think that'd be plenty. So if they had the AEW world title and a clear secondary title and a TNT title, I'm fine with that. I think AEW has a big enough roster to support that. But no trios title, no other men singles titles, and no second women's title. I just think unless you have an equal number of women roughly as men, you don't need to have two titles representing them. So that's kind of my overview take on just generically speaking the belts too, Brent, which I know you brought up. So yeah, anything else you want to bring up, Brent, before we move on?
If anything, women's tag titles would serve a better purpose than the TBS title because at least it would give the other women not involved in the world title picture at least something to do.
You don't need a title to be doing something, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It could still serve a purpose at some point. If you get rid of a bunch of the secondary titles, maybe you could have room to insert that in at some point. But anyway, I don't share the positive opinions on Jade Cargill. I think she needs a significant amount of work for her promos and her wrestling. Is she a lot better than she was in 2020? I forget when she debuted. It was like 2020 or something. Yes. Pushing someone to the moon like that who hadn't wrestled a single match or cut a single promo in her life prior to that point, that was a big mistake. And she's about as cold as a turkey in the freezer at this point. And I think there needs to be some reassessing on that. I think she does have to lose at some point. And relatively soon, in my humble opinion, if they can build somebody up to do that. But I'll go with my last point is Roosh is an absolute gem. He really is. The guy's a phenomenal wrestler. He's actually trying to learn English, and he's somewhat more intelligible than Andrade El Idolo. How that's the case, I don't know. And he knows not, and he's not a pain in the ass like El Idolo is backstage trying to assault wrestlers backstage and everything. I really think they should push him more and maybe give him some significant wins and maybe build him up either for a TNT title reign at some point or maybe be the one that knocks off Orange Cassidy for the Atlantic title if they're just going to keep up that stupid secondary belt. But anyway, Thanks for taking the call, and you guys have a good night.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling. Arush comes with his own baggage backstage. He came in with a reputation, had one prior, just being, you know, difficult to work with, not wanting to do jobs. There was baggage with him. It's not to say he's not on his best behavior now, or can't improve, and he is super talented in the ring. But it's important to have a character. I'm not sure we saw a ton of that tonight. It's just him and Preston just being opponents. It didn't, whatever story they told, it didn't resonate enough with me to justify it feeling like a big co-main event type match. And you know, they were, I think, probably gun-shy to feature it that way, even if they did get the biggest font, so to speak, in the poster. Jake, anything you want to say to what Brian had to say about Jade Cargill or Rouge?
Well, yeah, I hope they're building up Jade Cargill, you know, eventually to give somebody that, that rub when she loses her undefeated streak. I don't necessarily know who that is at this point. You know, maybe it's just as simple as, hey, we can solve, you know, this major problem we have with the split in the division by unifying the championships. And you can do that by having the AEW Women's Champion, you know, unify the titles at that point. But, as far as Rouge goes, yeah, he's incredibly talented. As you mentioned, Wade, he did have a bit of a reputation coming into the company, particularly around not wanting to lose matches when it came time for him to lose matches. But that hasn't seemingly been too much of an issue since he came to AEW, and so maybe things have changed, or he's had a change in attitude. I can't say that he won't be, you know, a fixture in the main event at some point, because you know he does have just incredible in-ring chops. It's just a matter of, you know, establishing that character, and whether it involves having a manager like Jose doing the talking for him, or whether he can improve his English skills over the next couple of years to the point where he can do promos by himself. I don't know what the answer is to that, but he's a bit far away from where you'd say, okay, we can feature this guy in main event stories and sell pay-per-views with him. I think he does have that credibility where people expect him to have great matches, but I can't say that he's much of a storyteller in the sense that people have become accustomed to when it comes to main event wrestling in the U.S.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Let's go next to area code 915. And by the way, if you're live streaming and joining us midstream, still feel free to call. You're invited to call us right now, 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And push 1 on your keypad when you call in. You do not need to listen from the beginning to participate in the show. Your opinion still counts, even if you bring up a topic we've already covered. All right, 915, thanks for calling. Go ahead and state your name and the city you're calling from.
Good evening, gentlemen. My name is Anthony Foster. I'm calling from El Paso, Texas, via Detroit, Michigan.
Cool. Well, what's on your mind about Dynamite tonight, for all the way from Texas?
You know, when I was watching Dynamite tonight, you know, one of the first things that I really noticed, you know, just maybe not to pile on like the last caller, but it was a underwhelming show to me, you know what I'm saying, just as far as what I usually see or what I usually watch, you know, when I tune in. I hadn't always been an every Wednesday watcher. But any time I would, you know, jump in, I just felt like I was watching an exciting wrestling show. Tonight seemed to, you know, kind of peter that off a little bit, but I think it had something to do with the opening match. And, you know, to me it seemed like the opening match, even though that, you know, Jeff Jarrett was game, you know, rest in peace to his pops. But, like, you know, when they came out, it seemed like they was getting ready to put on a good match. Just, you know, just last week I was in El Paso and I watched the Acclaim, you know, I seen those boys in the ring doing what they do. But this time around in this particular match, it just feels like there was a lot of missteps, a lot of, you know, a lot of waiting for a move to happen. It could have been something that they maybe pieced together, you know, last minute or so, but it did not seem like a good match to me overall. What about you, gentlemen? What did you think about that match?
Jake, I'll have you go first.
Yeah, I guess I would echo your sentiments. I think there were a couple of missed time spots. There also was sort of this unfortunate moment where the camera operator kind of caught Billy Gunn kneeling on the outside of the ring watching the action. And he was very visible on the left side of your screen, just kind of waiting to go back in and break up a pinfall. And so, yeah, I think there was a lot of little production snafus that probably hurt that match as well, along with, you know, waiting for moves and standing in place and waiting for the guy to be ready for the next spot. And so, it wasn't a winner in my book from an opener standpoint. And it wasn't offensive to the point where it was like channel changing or something, but it certainly wasn't the best effort we've seen from the guys that were involved.
And it was a Jeff Jarrett special. You know, if there's one twist and turn, then seven twists and turns with shenanigans and interference, then it's going to be better. You know, there's just so much of that with pretty consistently with Jeff Jarrett matches going back to Memphis, frankly, but also, you know, TNA when he had the lengthiest time in charge of his own matches and others' matches. And so, you know, the match was played more for comedy than being what I think people expect AEW to be or think AEW's niche ought to be. I mean, this was a match with Jeff Jarrett deep into his 50s, Satnam Singh, who they don't trust to do much at all for good reason, I think, at this point. Sanjay Dutt, a retired goofball manager, and, you know, Jay Lethal as the one guy, you know, on the tail end of his prime trying to keep, you know, hold things together. And then he kind of, you know, a weird team too with Orange Cassidy suddenly with the Acclaimed in a match with Billy Gunn also wrestling also deep into his 50s. You know, I mean, that's what it was. And it is, if you tune in and you have a certain idea of what you think AEW ought to be and then you watch this match, this is a big step away from that. This is very much in a different category, and it can set the tone for the brand and the perception that fans have of AEW that's different than what might be the best strategy for AEW, even if it's competently executed. And in this case, it's flawed. I don't want to say it's competent or incompetent, but, you know, it was flawed. Anthony, back to you for follow-up for a different topic.
Yes. Well, you know, another topic I think I would like to jump on, or just to, you know, maybe just a comment when it came to the main event and just something that I noticed about Ruby Soho, maybe over time or, you know, I mean, I see it a lot, of course, now that she's on AEW television, is that, boy, does she continue to play to the last row of the building, you know, I mean, like in every move,
yeah,
every facial expression, you know, as she's working, she is letting, you know, me all the way in the nosebleeds, you know, screaming that Ruby isn't dead, and she's, you know, she's still wrestling for every last one of us, you know. So I just kind of want to comment on that. You know, I feel maybe appreciate that. You know, maybe some people, I mean, I've talked to some people about it, and they say, like, yeah, man, you know, I think she's still, you know, that she's overacting. But, you know, most of these people that I do talk to about wrestling hadn't been to indie shows and don't really get all the way into, you know, maybe every aspect of wrestling. You know, they just see kind of what happens with WWE, and they, you know, they think one way or another, you know, but I think it's just really awesome the way that she continues to play to the last row of the building.
Sometimes playing to the last row of the building can be a positive, and sometimes it can be a negative. Sometimes it can be, it's good for a house show, but on television when there's a close-up, it can look sometimes like, you know, cheerleaders with a pasted-on smile that's exaggerated so people far away can see their facial expressions as you know, you often see there. But, you know, your thoughts, Jake, on Ruby Soho's persona and what she projects. And I'll add to it, if you think she'll make for a good heel in this environment, if that's the direction they go.
Yeah, I guess the mannerisms and the facial expressions and the selling, you know, I think if you're somebody who's watching, you know, high definition TV, it can come. Yeah, you're probably right. It does come across as overacting, but you know, she's definitely worked out those habits, you know, whether it was working the house shows in WWE or her long successful independent career, it's just seemingly something that she does. But I think it can be interpreted as a negative if you're trying to tell a subtle, you know, story with facial expressions for the close-up cameras. But I don't really think she's tasked to do that very much. And so maybe it just hasn't struck me as being a negative personally. But I do appreciate the fact that, you know, that she does sell and that she does make her opponents look great, in you know, even when she's losing those matches most of the time, at least on the AEW main roster. And so I do give her props for that. But going forward as a heel, I mean, I always thought she had – a lot of potential, you know, just whether it was with, you know, the Riot Squad, WWE, as poorly as that went at times, or her run in NXT, you know, I think she plays both sides of the character alignment coin pretty well. I do think they missed an opportunity with her as a babyface, not pulling the trigger, you know, a couple of times, and her seemingly getting demoted and people kind of losing interest in her character. So I think a heel turn at this point will at least give her a fresh start and a chance to make that connection with the crowd again that maybe got interrupted a few times through her run up until this point. So I'm looking forward to seeing her hopefully get some promo time and an ability to do some character work as a heel.
All right, very good. Anthony, anything else you want to add?
Well, yeah, just to, you know, to follow up on that one, you know, I think it would be really good, really great to see her, you know, flip as a heel. I think she got one of the best looks, you know what I'm saying, of being bringing, you know, a really big eyes, you know, to that dark persona and under that bang that she has there, the bangs, looking up and looking into the camera, you know. So like with those expressions, I think she probably could do pretty good for TV, and you know, and look really good on the poster as well. And I guess, you know, the last thing I would like to say about the show, you know, Mr. Keller, you've kind of mentioned this, you know, a few times beforehand in the past about Kenny and the Bucks not really giving, you know what I'm saying, giving us much to, you know, to continue to endear them outside of, you know, going in the ring and doing their thing, you know, again, just like, you know, just like last week in El Paso, we didn't get any kind of any live interaction with those guys, you know, other than a wrestling match. You know, the wrestling match, it was awesome. We loved it. We turned up for it, you know, and it was, you know, for me, amazing. I was like, you know, wow, here I am, not too far away from Kenny Omega, you know, someone that I've watched and seen in New Japan wrestling for so, so long, never really getting a chance to actually be in a venue, you know, to be somewhat up close and personal. And, you know, I would love some kind of quirkiness from him, you know, and the same thing with the Bucks. I mean, you know, everyone else got dick jokes going on with the show. You know, let's get some of them live. You know, let the crowd feel them, hear them, you know, and continue to endear them outside of, again, just getting that really, really good match on. And I do believe that it's somewhat, you know, is going to possibly hurt them in the long run. I mean, of course, you know, they're professionals, and if they get heated up for something cool, as far as, you know, when they want to get back in the storyline, and I don't know if they're keeping them kind of away from those interactions because they're not too sure how crowds or how we're going to start feeling about, like, hey, wait a minute, you know, do we know anything about CM Punk? Are we just kind of keeping them under wraps? You know, is there anything official? Because, you know, usually most of your AEW fans are slightly more smartened up than most, you know, so of course we have a slightly different understanding of the product outside of just, you know, we know that it's a TV show. But I really do think they're doing some damage long term by not giving us, you know, those wrestlers somewhat in the capacity that we would love to still feed off them, you know, getting those personas from them.
Jake, anything you want to react to there from Anthony?
Well, I've been in a just as puzzled as everybody else as to why, you know, the Young Bucks and Omega have not been in front of microphones on television, you know, trying to reintroduce themselves post, you know, that situation with CM Punk and how out of control that was and how much press it got. And, you know, it seems like we've really only seen them in backstage skits that are 30 seconds to a minute long. And we don't really know who they are at this point, you know, outside of just their reputations. And so I think it's long overdue that we hear more from Kenny Omega, that we hear more from the Young Bucks. And I hope, you know, at some point they find a way out of the trios division so that they can be contributors to where I think they shine. And then, you know, the Young Bucks in the tag division, Kenny Omega as a main event singles act. You know, we really haven't seen the Kenny Omega babyface, you know, run at MJF or another heel champion. You know, we only saw quirky Kenny Omega the heel, and I don't know if that was necessarily his best work, especially considering how many injuries he was dealing with at the time. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of untapped potential with all three of those guys, and I hope they get to it at some point, because it would feel like a waste if they just avoid the, you know, the promo game because they're afraid of what might happen if, you know, they say the wrong thing in front of a live crowd.
Yeah, the way Kenny and the Bucks, at least by appearances on television, present themselves and their commitment to the full range of what they could be doing for the job, it's an endorsement of the Vince McMahon downside guarantee, and then you earn your anything above it approach over those years. You know, there was something to be said for human nature, and there's a level of contentment, complacency, with the Bucks and Kenny that is, you know, in their mind might be justified, or they think they're doing enough, or they're trying to be team players. You know, at the beginning it was like, oh, the EVPs aren't going to overpush themselves, and it turned out they just didn't seem like they could be bothered to come up with top-level content other than doing what they did on indie shows. And it's just, it's a completely different setting and list of demands the things that you do to be a successful top act in a TV weekly TV show is different than being a star in Japan or being a star in the indie scene. And they just haven't adjusted. And, you know, Tony Khan's either too busy or has lost leverage with them or is fine with good matches, because that's, you know, where his focus is. But man, there were moments where they could have really taken it to the next level and increased the swath of people who were really into their characters, and they have not taken advantage of those opportunities. Both Kenny and the Bucks, I think, have had moments where I thought, okay, this is when it's going to come, where they're going to really broaden their appeal and add new fans to their base. And now we're at a point where I don't think that's important to them. And if it is, they're not good at showing it. All right, Anthony, I appreciate your call. Call again.
Thank you very much. You know what I'm saying, appreciate being able to talk to both of you gentlemen. I've listened to you for years. You know what I'm saying, everybody hit up wrestling.net. Everybody go VIP if you're thinking about it. I thought about it for like, I don't know, maybe 5 years, you know, that I listened as a free member. And then once I went VIP, I haven't turned back around. I wouldn't dare do it. You know, I just really appreciate how both of you gentlemen, you know what I'm saying, have smartened me up over the years. And hopefully I'll talk to you again.
Great, Anthony. Thanks for your kind words so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jake, absolutely. Jake, good chance for you to plug here what you do for ProWrestling.net and the ability to listen and read your stuff free, but also subscribe.
Yeah, so ProWrestling.net is the website. I do a weekly television report. Typically, it's AEW Dynamite. Some weeks I get flexed over to SmackDown, depending on what's going on in my home life. But I also record a weekly podcast called .NET Weekly with Jason Powell. It's the flagship show for members. I also join Jason for the reviews of pay-per-views for both WWE and AEW. You can read all about, you know, both the standard membership and the audio membership, which is available through Patreon, if you visit pwmembership.net.
All right, very good. Another email here from Jay from Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Wade, just three simple thoughts following tonight's Dynamite. One, I'm excited that AEW is featuring a woman's storyline beyond just title matches, although where is Jade? However, beyond the Ruby in the Middle storyline, it's basically impossible to explain why there is a random three-way match. You can kind of reason a triple threat in your mind when there are multiple possible challengers for a title or something, but it's weird to see such a match when there isn't anything in particular on the line. What did Ruby gain in victory? She didn't pick a side, and she pinned babyface Britt Baker with a roll-up. She did the ubiquitous belt gesture, so maybe they can at least push her as the number one contender based on this victory. Your first, any thoughts you want to add to those topics, Jake, from what Jay said?
No, I think it's sound reasoning. You know, a lot of the television matches in AEW just feel like they're thrown together with, okay, we have this story going on. There was something on Dark, there was something on Rampage, there was a backstage segment on Dynamite that didn't necessarily seem like it wasn't hugely significant, but then Tony just books matches out of it. And I think the fact that they've had this ongoing story with Ruby, will she or won't she join the AEW Originals or this new, Renegade faction, whatever you want to call them. I think that's enough story to put this match together. Now, what's the significance of it? I think it is going to build towards some kind of triple threat at the pay-per-view where it's either Saraya or Toni Storm and Ruby Soho challenging Jamie Hayter for that AEW Women's Championship. And, they carry this story all the way to the pay-per-view as to, what Ruby Soho is going to do. And if she does turn heel and join Saraya and Storm, can Hayter and Baker, overcome the numbers disadvantage of having three heels outnumbering them, and will they have to recruit others to help? And that's why, frankly, I'm not terribly thrilled about it, because it continues to make another division in the company built around faction wars rather than individual contributors doing excellent character work and telling good stories. And so, that's kind of where I'm at with the main event of the show. I wish it had gone down a little bit differently. We would have gotten more story advancement, and I kind of wish that this division was doing something else, but we are where we are.
All right, number two, he says, with the large calendar gaps between pay-per-views, I'm often concerned about AEW's ability to stretch storylines until the next big event. Now we're like 2 weeks from the show, and prior to tonight, there was really only one match announced for Revolution, the obvious main event of MJF and Danielson. While there have been obvious matches headed that direction, there are still some major gaps to fill in. Surely the Elite will be defending the Trios title. Orange Cassidy has an All-Atlantic title. Are we going to have a pay-per-view without a House of Black or Death Triangle? We're short on time to build some of these. What do you think of the pacing of pay-per-view builds? Because when you think about how long they have to tell stories and then how crammed at the end it seems like they do put the final lineup together, it just exacerbates the issue. It'd be like, storylines are drawn out, but it's okay to kind of settle in on a lineup with a few weeks to go, so it's not all coming together late. It doesn't make or break a pay-per-view. Like, it's not like people are going to order a pay-per-view, aren't going to be aware of the lineup, and aren't watching often enough to at least be up on the storylines, even if things aren't officially announced three or four or 5 weeks before pay-per-view. But it does seem like it would be better to get to the point where the matches are announced, and then you have a couple of weeks at least, 2-3 weeks, to just reinforce them, as opposed to have it all culminate in Tony Khan has just made this official for a bunch of the matches on the last Dynamite and sometimes even after the last Dynamite. Your take on the pacing of lineups taking shape.
Yeah, this isn't the first time. And it's probably going back, well into 2022, maybe even post-Revolution last year, where it seems like the pacing of weekly TV is dictated by the need to, okay, we need to have at least this many strong matches on every television show, and if that means that 2/3 of the show isn't dedicated to building the pay-per-view, then so be it. And that leads to the last couple of weeks ahead of a pay-per-view just being crammed with challenges and last minute matches coming together. And it takes away from the significance of some of the bigger matches. Now, I think they've done a nice job of stretching out the Danielson and MJF story over the past couple of months to the point where, okay, now you know, now 3 weeks heading into the pay-per-view, they had a strong segment tonight, and now they have two more opportunities to really promote that match. But you can't really say that about really anything else. And so I do agree that the pacing of the television show or, you know, the weeks of the television show heading into the pay-per-views does seem a bit flawed. I much would have rather had the pay-per-view lineup mostly finalized tonight, so they had two full weeks of Dynamite to really hammer home the significance of the matches, you know, create more personal stakes or heighten the stakes between competitors on the matches for the show and really send the thing home. But we're probably going to be booking matches for the pay-per-view right up until the Rampage going into the show on the weekend. And I think that's just an unfortunate consequence of what the booking priorities are for Tony in most cases. And he's publicly acknowledged this before, you know, that he thinks that most people are completely fine with having, you know, things come together. And he feels like, you know, their viewership in the weeks, the 2 weeks heading into the pay-per-view are higher because people are tuning in to see what's getting booked for the show. But I continue to see it as somewhat missed opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. And Jay's third point, good to see Jim Ross utilized beyond Rampage commentary. He's always been good at these sit-down interviews, and Wardlow, I think, came off well in the setting. He even explained why Joe cutting off his hair was more disrespectful than a typical haircut. Hopefully this helps keep the crowd on Wardlow's side against a quite popular opponent in Samoa Joe. Glad Jay brought that up. I don't want to get through this without bringing up that sit-down promo with Wardlow. I thought he looks, like, way better with this look than the previous haircut and the kind of put-on facial expression. I feel like I have a better idea of who Wardlow is, and instead of just what he was standing behind MJF with all the potential in the world, but none of it realized in terms of a character. And it's been rocky since then, and I thought this was a promising foundation to build on. I thought the pivot from a regular guy to leaning forward into the camera felt a little put on, but overall I thought it was a good performance. What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, you know, I thought the addition of the story, you know, about how you know, talking about his dad and, you know, how, you know, they had a long lapse in their relationship. And then, you know, when he and his dad came together again, when he was an adult, you know, he decided to kind of grow his hair and his beard out as a tribute to his father. I don't know if that's, you know, something, if the long hair that he had was a reflection of, I don't know when his dad passed exactly, so I don't know, I can't attest to the accuracy of the story, but I do think it was a nice character detail and establishing, you know, a strong personal motivation for wanting to get some revenge on Samoa Joe for what he did. I do, I guess I, you know, in hindsight, I wish they would have, you know, established this motivation for him before they cut his hair, like, because it feels like they're sort of filling in the details backwards, and I don't know if it necessarily removes the impact of that revelation, but man, I think in the moment it would have gotten Samoa Joe a lot more heat for cutting his hair if we'd have known, you know, the significance of it at the time. But other than that, I think Wardlow came across well. He seems like he's a personable guy, likable guy. The story was relatable in a sense, you know, about, you know, his family struggles. And then, you know, I know, you know, I don't know anybody whose life who hasn't been touched by a cancer battle at this point. And so all of that, you know, really, really dovetailed in nicely. But I guess, you know, hindsight being 2020, I might have done the haircut thing a little bit differently.
Yep. Okay, we've covered, I've got one more I want to get to, but we've covered everything other than we haven't brought up the Mark Briscoe-Josh Woods match. What do you think of Mark Briscoe in the context of AEW and this match being on Dynamite?
Well, they announced after the show that Mark Briscoe is All Elite, so it sounds like he'll be featured more regularly going forward. But I guess without that being the context, I wasn't really sure if Mark was going to be working in ROH primarily, if they had plans for him, you know, to what they were going to do with those ROH tag titles. You know, obviously the situation with his brother was incredibly tragic, and you know, he's done an amazing job of keeping it together, at least from my perspective. But I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what he can do as a singles act. I think he, you know, obviously he has this hugely relatable story about loss that he can tell through the context of wrestling and that providing him with motivation. You know, do I necessarily think that you know, AEW has done, you know, the best work of telling, you know, really nuanced stories? Not necessarily. So I'm hopeful that they can turn the corner with something like this. I think Mark is a great wrestler, and you know, he's contributed to singles wrestling in Ring of Honor over the years in meaningful ways, and so I think he can do the same here. It's just a matter of, you know, how do you make him stand out from the crowd in AEW? I think it's going to be difficult going forward.
All right, so we'll probably wrap up on this note. This is Charles C. in Richmond, Wisconsin. Says, it's been a long time coming, but after this week's flagship, here we go. I was a very long time exclusive WWE guy until getting burned out and switching over to AEW when they launched. At that time, I was assuming I would have a learning curve on adapting to new characters in a new style, but this many years in, I would have expected to be more familiar than I am with the week-to-week folk, but I'm not. Maybe it's partially my fault since I don't follow everyone on social media. I don't watch Dark. I don't watch other random YouTube shows, let alone New Japan, PWG, ROH, etc., from the past 30 years. I thought that learning curve was just an initial hurdle, but I don't feel I've been introduced to anyone new along the way, and if nothing else, it's probably gotten worse with the Forbidden Door, the random dream match of the week, or whatever. I still want to be an AEW guy, but their approach makes it hard for me. Like for Revolution, it's a way too long show. The elite matches are always skippable, even if you could ignore that the championship match was more predictable than a Roman-Sammy match, that it's still a tough pill to swallow at the end of an already long and expensive show. My initial thought when taking a break from WWE was they do enough repeats and recaps that only watching once a month or two was enough to not be in the dark, but obviously might not be as attached as the week-to-week viewers. That kind of proved itself out at Raw 30 for me when I tuned in for the first time in years but ended up just skipping over anything that wasn't old-school content. So as a day-one guy that apparently belongs in the third million instead of the first K, is there hope of tweaks to keep things more interesting? So, I mean, this email is – you know, reflective of how I felt about AEW's approach that I think has limited their growth. And I think Charles is articulating the fan that I have for 3.5 years of Dynamite's existence without wanting to be too redundant and too like preachy about it, I guess, it's the epitome of that person who I've been talking about. Like that AEW should be working harder to appeal to, reach out to, make comfortable with their product in a way that would not cost any of the people who are part of the first group who still love the product today for what it is without turning any of them off. You can check the boxes that would have Charles, our emailer here, be enthusiastic and engaged and invested instead of frustrated and disengaged and feeling distant from the characters. So this is I save this for last because, I mean, I think this is an email that Tony Khan and others in AEW would behoove them to listen to fans like Charles and have a real open discussion and reassessment of their approach and figure out what it is that is frustrating and pushing Charles away that they clearly are not even aware of or have, I think, disregarded at their own peril. Jake, your reaction to Charles, which just seems like a plea. Please, I want to be an AEW fan, but you got to do your part, AEW.
Yeah, I guess from a conversational standpoint, it just feels like, Wade, shall we beat the dead horse again? You know, because it feels like we have this conversation every time I'm on to talk about Dynamite, but I think the key phrase from his statement there was, you know, I'm a routine watcher and I don't feel like I know any of these characters. And I think that's, you know, that goes back to, you know, what is it that gets people to tune in and keep tuning in to weekly wrestling television? And I think there's been sort of a school of thought in AEW that they feel like it's the matches and it's the quality of the matches and it's the, you know, it's the content that takes place between the ropes that keeps people glued to the show. And, you know, obviously they have, you know, some some stories ongoing, you know, like MJF and Bryan Danielson that aren't necessarily that type of content all the time. But, you know, even that feud has been mostly tent-poled by Bryan Danielson dream matches on television from week to week. And so I think there is something to be learned from, you know, from statements like this where it's like, okay, we're spending too much of our time between the ropes and not enough time really making the connection between our characters and the audience. And I've been begging, you know, for years now for more content on the microphone, you know, even if it's not perfect, you know, even if it's deeply flawed at times, allow some of these characters who don't really get a chance to talk the ability to make that connection, because if they never get an opportunity, then they never get a chance to improve. And so, you know, if you're afraid that you're going to drive away a certain super hardcore wrestling fan by having talking segments, I think you're making a mountain out of a molehill there. I think people will tune in to a show that they obviously adore and stick with it, even though it doesn't feature, you know, 92 minutes of wrestling on, you know, a 99 minute wrestling show, you know, and that's something that I'll stand by. I really do think that there's the wrong mix of content on AEW TV a lot of weeks. And I think they'd hold on to more viewers by, even if it's 10 or 20% more, you know, interview or promo or personality related content, you know, you're going to get people more invested in these stories, more invested in these characters. And I think that's what gets people to come back. And I think if you're a new viewer tuning in, that's what helps you sort of gain the context for what's happening in the ring. Because if you don't really understand the reason for any of these people to fight, then it's just, you know, it's just like slap fights that comes on right after, you know, the show. It's just essentially just violence for the sake of violence. And I'm not sure how much of an audience there is for that, especially when everybody knows that wrestling is predetermined at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well put. All right. Jake, anything else you want to add from Dynamite tonight?
No, I think we covered everything.
Yeah. Cool. Excellent. Thanks, Jake Barnett. Thanks to our emailers, our callers, our listeners, and we'll talk to y'all next time. Thanks.